"You are full of conspiracy theories," said Sarima. "I've noticed that about you." This was an elderly gentleman, very elderly, and he spoke with an accent. He surely was a wandering magician from some other place. And hasn't he been right? The thing has sat here forgotten for, what, 10 years or more already. May I take it and look at it? I don't care. He never said not to read it, said Sarima. At the time, I perhaps couldn't read at all, I forget. But look at that beautiful angel there. Do you really mean to say you don't believe in the other land? In an afterlife? Just what we need, Elphaba snorted as she picked up the tome. A post-Veil of Tears, Veil of Tears. One morning, after Six had tried and given up once again at some sort of lessons for the children, Irgi suggested an indoor game of hide-and-seek. They drew straws, and Noor lost, so she hid her eyes and counted. When she got bored with waiting, she called out, 100, and looked about. She tagged Lear first. Though he liked to disappear alone for hours at a time, he was bad at hiding when it was required of him. So they hunted together for the older boys, and found Irgi in Sarima's solar, crouching behind the velvet ruffles suspended from the perch of a stuffed griffon. But Manik, the best at hiding, couldn't be found. Not in the kitchen, the music room, the towers. Running out of ideas, the children even dared to go down into the musty basement. "There's tunnels from here all the way to hell," said Irgi. "Where? Why?" said Noor, and Lear echoed. "They're hidden. I don't know where, but everybody says so. Ask Six. I think because this used to be a waterworks headquarters. It did. Hell burns so hot, they need water, and the devil's tunneled up to here." Noor said, "Look, Weir, here's the fish well." In the center of a low-vaulted room, damp with moisture beaded up on its stone walls, stood a low well with a wooden lid. There was a simple device with a chain and a stone for shifting the lid sideways. It was child's play to uncover the shaft. "Down there," said Irgi, "is where we get the fish we eat. Nobody knows if there's a whole lake down there, or if it's bottomless, or if you can go down right to hell." He moved the rushlight about, and there was a round of black water shining back a reflection in chips and circles of chilly white light.
"Six says there's a gold carp in there," said Noor. "She saw it once. Biggest old thing. She thought it was a floating brass kettle bobbing to the surface, and then it turned and looked at her."
"Maybe it was a brass kettle," said Lear.
"Kettles don't have eyes," said Noor.
"Anyway, Manik's not here," said Irgi.
"Is he?"
he called. "Hello, Manik!" And the echo rolled and dissolved in the wet dark.
"Maybe Manik went down to hell in one of those tunnels," said Lear.
Irgi swung the lid back on the fish well.
"But you're it, Noor. I'm not going to look down here anymore."
They gave themselves the creeps and raced back upstairs. Four yelled at them for making too much noise. Noor found Manik at last on the stairs outside the door to Auntie Guest's rooms.
"Shh," he said as they came near, and Noor tapped him anyway, saying,
"You're out."
"Shh," he said again, more urgently.
They took turns looking through the crack in the weathered grain of the door. Auntie had her finger in a book, and she was mumbling things to herself, sounding them out this way and that. On the dresser next to her squatted Chistery in an uneasy, obedient silence.
"What's happening?" said Noor.
"She's trying to teach him to talk," said Manic.
"Let me look," said Lear.
"Say spirit," said Auntie in a kind voice. "Say spirit, spirit, spirit."
Chister had twisted his mouth to one side, as if considering it. "There is no difference," said Auntie to herself, or maybe to Chistery. "The strands are the same, the skeins are the same, the rock remembers, the water has memory, the air has a past for which it can be held accountable, the flame renews itself like a phoenix. What is an animal but made of rock and water and fire and ether? Remember how to speak, Chistery. You are animal, but animal is your cousin, damn you. Say spirit."
Chistery picked a nit off his chest and ate it.
"Spirit," sang Auntie. "There is spirit. I know it. Spirit."
"Spit," said Chistery, or something like it.
Irgy shoved Manic aside, and the children almost fell through the door, trying to see Auntie laugh and dance and sing. She picked up Chistery and hugged him and said, "Spirit, oh, spirit, Chistery, there is spirit. Say spirit."
"Spit, spit, spit,"
said Chistery, unimpressed with himself.
"Spite."
But Killyjoy woke from a nap at the sound of a new voice.
"Spirit," said Auntie.
"Speared," said Chistery patiently. "Spared, spored, sput, 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 spat, spate, spit, speed, spurt, spot."
"Spirit," said Auntie. "Oh, my Chistery, we'll find ourselves a link with Dr. Dillamon's old work yet. There is a universal design among us all. Could we get in deeply enough to see? Everything is not in vain. Spirit, my friend, spirit."
"Sport," said Chistery.
The children couldn't stop laughing. They clattered down the stairs and fell into the dormitory and giggled into the bedclothes. They didn't mention what they saw to Sarima or the sisters. They were afraid Auntie would be stopped, and they all wanted Chistery to learn enough language so that he could play with them. One windless day, when it seemed they must get out of Kiamoko or expire of boredom, Sarima had the idea that they go skating on a nearby pond. The sisters agreed and dug out the rusting skates Fiero had brought back from the Emerald City. The sisters baked caramel sweets and prepared flasks of cocoa and even decorated themselves with green and gold ribbons, as if it were a second Lerlinmus. Sarima adorned herself in a brown velvet robe with fur tippets. The children put on extra trousers and tunics, and even Elphaba came along in a thick cloak of purple brocade and heavy Arjiki goatskin boots and mittens, carrying her broom. Chistery lugged along a basket of dried apricots. The sisters, in sensible men's tribal overcoats, belted and latched, drew up the rear. The villagers had cleared the snow off the center of the pond. It was a ballroom dance floor of silver plate, engraved with the flourishes of 1,000 arabesques, mounded round with pillows and bolsters of snow, to provide a safe repose for skaters who forget how to break or turn. In the fierce sunlight, the mountains looked razor-sharp against the blue. Great snowy egrets and ice griffins wheeled high above. The ice rink was already noisy with screaming urchins and lurching adolescents, taking every opportunity to tumble and heap each other cozily in suggestive positions. Their elders moved more slowly, processionally around the ice. The crowd fell silent as the household of Kiamoko approached, but children being children, the silence didn't last for long. Sarima ventured out onto the ice, her sisters in a knot around her with linked arms. Being largish, Sarima was nervous of falling, nor were her ankles strong. But before long she had remembered how things went, this foot, then that, long, languorous strides, and the uneasy meeting of social classes was accomplished. Elphaba looked like one of her crows, knees out, elbows flailing, rags flapping, gloved hands raking for balance. After the adults had had enough excitement, but the children were only still warming up, Sarima and the sisters and Elfie collapsed on some bearskins that the citizenry had spread out for them. "In the summer," said Sarima, "we have a huge bonfire and slaughter some pigs before the men descend to the plains, or the boys ascend to the slopes to guard the sheep and the goats. They all come into the castle for a chew of pork and a few tankards of ale. And, of course, any time there's a mountain lion or a particularly nasty bear, we let them into the keep until the beast is killed or wanders away." She smiled with noblesse oblige, in an abbreviated way, off into the middle distance, though the locals were ignoring the castle folk by now. "Auntie dear, you looked quite the sight in that robe, and poking along with that broom." "Weir says it's a magic broom," said Noor, who had run up to throw a handful of granular snowflakes into her mother's face. Elphaba turned her head quickly and tugged her collar up to avoid ricocheting snow spray. Noor laughed unkindly in a beautiful phrase like a woodwind and scampered away. "So tell us how your broom came to be magic," said Sarima. "I never said it was magic. I got it from an elderly Mont named Mother Yackel. She took me under her wing, when she was alert enough, and gave me, well, guidance, I suppose you'd call it."
"Guidance," said Sarima.
"The old Mont said the broom would be my link to my destiny," said Elfie. I assume she meant that my destiny was domestic, not magic.
"Join the sisterhood," Sarima yawned. "I never knew if Mother Yackel was completely mad or a wise prophetic old hen," said Elfie, but the others weren't listening, so she lapsed into silence. After a while, Noor came flinging herself into her mother's lap again. "Tell me a story, Mama," she said. "Those boys are nasty."
"Boys are vexing creatures," agreed her mother. "Sometimes."
"Shall I tell you the story of when you were born?"
"No, not that," said Noor, yawning.
"A wheel story. Tell me about the witch and the fox babies again."
Sarima protested, knowing full well that the children considered Auntie Guest a witch. But Noor was stubborn, and Sarima relented and told the tale. Elphaba listened. Her father had taught her moral precepts, had lectured her about responsibility. Nanny had gossiped. Nessa Rose had whined. But no one had told stories to her when she was young. She pulled herself forward a little so she could hear over the noise of the crowd. Sarima recited the tale with little dramatic involvement, but even so, Elphaba felt a twinge when she heard the conclusion.
"And there the wicked old witch stayed for a good long time."
"Did she ever come out?" recited Noor, eyes gleaming with the fun of the ritual.
"Not yet,"
answered Sarima, and leaned forward, pretending to bite Noor on the neck. Noor squealed and jiggled herself away and ran to rejoin the boys.
"I think that's shameful, even if it's just a story, to propose an afterlife for evil," said Elphaba.
"Any afterlife notion is a manipulation and a sop.
It's shameful the way the Unionists and the Pagans both keep talking up hell for intimidation and the airy other land for reward.
Don't, Serima said. For one thing, that's where Fiero is waiting for me. And you know it.
Elphaba's jaw dropped. When she least expected it, Serima always seemed ready to rush in with a surprise attack.
In the afterlife? Said Elfie.
Oh, what you do take against, said Serima. I pity the community of the afterlife when they're asked to welcome you in. What a sour apple you always are.
She's crazy, said Manic, knowledgeably. Everyone knows that you can't teach an animal to talk.
They were in the abandoned summer stable, jumping off a loft, making puffs of hay and snow billow in the patchy light.
Well, what is she doing with Chistri, then? Asked Irgi. If you're so sure of it.
She's teaching him to mimic like a parrot, said Manic.
I think she's magic, said Noor.
You think everything's magic, Manic said. Stupid girl.
Well, everything is, said Noor, launching herself away from the boys as a further editorial comment on their skepticism.
Do you really think she's magic? Said Manic to Lear. You know her better than any of us. She's your mother.
She's my auntie, isn't she? Lear said.
She's our auntie. She's your mother.
I know, said Irgi, pretending full immersion in the topic to avoid another jump. Lear is Chistri's brother. Lear is what Chistri was like before she taught him how to talk. You're a monkey, Lear.
I'm not a monkey, said Lear, and I'm not magic.
Well, let's go ask Chistri, said Manic. Is this the day that Auntie has her coffee with Mama? Let's go see if Chistri has learned enough words to answer some questions.
They scampered up the stone spiral staircase to Auntie Witch's apartment. True, she was gone, and there was Chistri nibbling on some nutshells, and Killyjoy dozing by the fire, growling in his sleep, and the bees doing their ceaseless chorus. The children didn't like bees much, nor did they care for Killyjoy. Even Lear had lost interest in the dog once he had children to play with. But Chistri was a favorite.
"Sweet thing, oh, the little baby," said Noor. "Here, you little beast, come to Auntie Noor."
The monkey looked doubtful, but then on knuckles and capable feet he swung across the floor and vaulted into her arms. He inspected her ears for treats, peered over her shoulders at the boys.
"You tell us, Chistri boy, is Auntie Witch wee-wee magic?" said Noor. "Tell us all about Auntie Witch."
"Watch, witch," said Chistri, playing with his fingers. "Witch, wretch, witch?" They could have sworn it was a question, the way his forehead wrinkled like eyebrows.
"Are you under a spell?" said Manic.
"Spell ill. Spoil spell," answered Chistri. "Spill all."
"How do we spoil the spell? How do we turn you back to a boy?" asked Irgi, the oldest, but just as caught up as the others. "Is there a special way?"
"Why way?" said Chistri. "Wee woo, wee way woe. Why?"
"Tell us what to do," said Noor, petting him.
"Do die," said Chistri.
"Great," said Irgi. "So we can't break the spell you're under?"
"Oh, he's only babbling," Elphaba said from the doorway.
"Look, I have visitors I didn't even invite."
"Oh, hello, Auntie," they said. They knew they shouldn't be there.
"He's talking, sort of. He's magicked."
"He mostly just repeats what you say," said Elphaba, moving closer. "So leave him alone.
You're not allowed here.
They said sorry and left. Back in the boys' room, they fell on the mattress and roared until they wept and couldn't say what was so funny. Maybe it was the relief of having escaped without harm from the witches' rooms, even though they had no business there. The children decided they were no longer scared of Auntie Witch. They were tired of being housebound, but finally it was raining out instead of snowing. They played hide-and-seek a lot, waiting for the rain to lift so they could go outside. One morning, Noor was it. She kept finding Manic easily, because Lear always hid near him and gave him away. Manic lost his patience. "I always get caught, because you're so hopeless. Why can't you hide well?" "I can't hide in the well," Lear said, misunderstanding. "Oh, yes, you can," Manic said, delighted. The next round began, and Manic led Lear right down the basement steps. The basement was even damper than usual, with the groundwater seeping through the foundation stones. When they swiveled the lid off the fish well, they could see the water level had risen. But it was still a good 12 or 14 feet down. "This'll just be fine," Manic said. "Look, if we loop the rope over this hook, the bucket will hold steady enough for you to climb in it. Then, when I let the crank out, the bucket will slowly slide down the side of the well. I'll stop it before it gets to the water, don't worry. Then I'll put the lid on, and Noor will look and look. She'll never find you." Lear peered into the clammy shaft. "What if there are spiders?"
"Spiders hate water," said Manic authoritatively. "Don't worry about spiders."
"Why don't you do it?" said Lear.
"You're not strong enough to lower me, that's why," said Manic patiently.
"Don't hide far away," said Lear. "Don't let me down too far. Don't push the cover on all the way. I don't like the dark."
"You're always complaining," Manic said, giving him a hand. "That's why we don't like you, you know."
"Well, everybody's mean to me," Lear said. "Crouch down now. Hold on to the ropes with both hands. If the bucket scrapes against the wall a little bit, just push yourself away. I'll let it down slowly."
"Where are you going to hide?" Lear said.
"There isn't any place else in this room."
"I'll hide under the stairs. She'll never find me in the shadows. She hates spiders."
"I thought you said there weren't any spiders."
"She thinks there are," Manic said. "One, two, three. This is a really good idea, Lear. You're so brave." He grunted with the effort. Lear was heavier in the bucket than he had figured, and the rope spooled too quickly. It jammed in the joint between the windlass and the struts, and the bucket stopped and smashed against the wall with an echoing thud.
"That was too fast," came Lear's voice, ghostly in the gloom.
"Oh, don't be a sissy," Manic said. "Now, shh, I'm going to pivot the cover back on part way so she won't guess. Don't make any noise."
"I think there's fish down here."
"Of course there are. It's a fish well."
"Well, I'm awfully near the water. Do they jump?"
"Yes, they jump, and they have sharp teeth, you ninny, and they like fat little boys," said Manic. "Of course they don't jump. Would I put you in danger like that if they did? Honestly, you don't trust me at all, do you?"
He sighed, as if disappointed beyond words, and when the cover slid all the way on instead of part way, he noted without surprise that Lear was too hurt to complain. Manic hid under the stairs for a little while. When Noor didn't come down, he decided that behind the altar skirts of the old musty chapel would be an even better hiding place.
"Be right back, Lear," he hissed.
But since Lear didn't answer, Manic guessed he was still nursing his grievances.
Sarima was taking a rare turn in the kitchen, concocting a stew out of limp vegetables from the keeping room. The sisters were having a dance recital amongst themselves in the music room overhead. "Sounds like a herd of elephants," Sarima said, when Auntie Guest came wandering through, looking for something to snack on. "I didn't expect to see you here," said Elphaba. "You know, I have a complaint to lodge against your children." "The sweet little vandals! What now?" Sarima said, stirring. "Have they been putting spiders in your bedsheets again?" "I wouldn't mind spiders. At least the crows could eat them." "No, Sarima, the children rifle through my belongings. They tease Chistery unmercifully, and they will not listen when I talk to them. Can't you do anything with them?"
"What's to be done?" said Sarima.
"Here, taste this rutabaga. Is it gone to the dogs?" "Even Killyjoy wouldn't touch this," decided Elfie. "You better stick with the carrots. I think those children are ungovernable, Sarima. Oughtn't they be off to school?" "Oh, yes, in a better life they would be, but how can they?" said their mother placidly. "I've already told you that they're sitting targets for ambitious Arjiki tribesmen. It's bad enough even to let them run around on the slopes near Kiamo Ko in the summer. I never know when they're going to be found, trussed and bled like a pig, and brought home for burying. It's the cost of widowhood, Auntie. We must do the best we can." "I was a good child," Elfie said stoutly. "I took care of my little sister, who was horribly disfigured from birth. I obeyed my father and my mother until she died. I tramped around as a missionary child and gave testimonials to the unnamed God, even though I was essentially faithless. I believed in obedience, and I don't believe it hurt me."
"Then what did hurt you?" asked Sarima wittily.
"You won't listen," said Elfie, "so I won't even say. But for whatever reasons, your children are ungovernable. I disapprove of your lax ways."
"Oh, children are good at heart," Sarima said, intent on scraping carrots.
"They are so innocent and gay. It cheers me up to see them dashing about the house in this game or that. All too soon these precious days will be past, dear Auntie, and then we will look back on when this house was filled with peals of childish laughter."
"Fiendish laughter!"
"There is something inherently good about children," said Sarima decidedly, warming to the subject. "You know that little Ozma, who all those years ago was deposed by the wizard? They say that she is off some place, frozen in a cave, perhaps even in the Kells, for all I know. She's preserved in her childhood innocence because the wizard hasn't the courage to kill her. One day she'll come back to rule Oz, and she'll be the best and wisest sovereign we ever had because of the wisdom of youth."
"I've never believed in child saviors," Elphaba said. "As far as I'm concerned, children are the ones who need saving."
"You're just cross because the children have such high spirits." "Your children are evil sprites," Elfie said in a snit. "My children aren't evil, nor were my sisters and I evil children."
"Your children aren't good," said Elfie.
"Well, how do you judge Lear in this regard, then?"
"Oh, Lear," Elfie said, and made an expression, and said "fa" with her tongue and hands.
Sarima was about to pursue this, a matter she had long been curious about, when three came rushing into the kitchen.
"The passes below us must have melted sooner than usual," she said, "for we have sighted a caravan struggling its way over the Loch Lim Trail, coming from the north. It'll be here by tomorrow."
"Oh, rapture," Sarima said, "and the castle's such a mess. This always happens. Why don't we learn? Quick, call the children, and we'll have to organize a scrub and polish. You never know, Auntie. It could be an honored guest. You have to be prepared." Manek and Nor and Irji came running from their game. Three told them the news, and they immediately had to dash up the highest tower to see what they could see through the slackening rain, and to wave aprons and handkerchiefs. Yes, there was a caravan, 5 or 6 skarks and a small wagon, pulling through the snow and the mud, having trouble fording this stream, stopping to mend a split wheel, stopping to feed the skarks. It was a wonderful treat, and all through the dinner meal of vegetable soup, the children chattered away at the surprises they might find among the passengers in the caravan. "They've never stopped thinking their father is going to come back," said Surima under her breath to Elphaba. "This excitement is a hope for him, though they don't remember it." "Where is Lear?" asked Four. "It's a perfect waste of good soup when he doesn't show up on time. He shan't get any if he comes whining to me afterward. Children, where is Lear?"
"He was playing with us earlier. Maybe he fell asleep," said Irji.
"Let's go set a bonfire and smoke the travelers a hello," said Manek, leaping from the table. It was lunchtime when the skarks and the wagon began the final difficult ascent up the slope to the castle portcullis and the gates of jasper and oak. The townspeople came out from their hovels and leaned their weight against the carriage, helping it through the ruts of mud and ice, until at last it turned in and crossed the open drawbridge. Elphaba, her curiosity as piqued as anyone else's, stood with the Dowager Princess of the Arjikis and her sisters on a parapet above the crudely carved front doorway. The children waited in the cobblestoned yard below, all but Lear. The leader, a grizzled young man, made the faintest mountain obeisance to Surima. The skarks defecated sloppily on the cobbles, to the delight of the children, who had never seen skark fumets before. Then the leader went to the cabin and opened the door and climbed inside. They could hear his voice raised loudly, as if talking to someone hard of hearing. They waited. The sky was a piercing blue, really almost a spring blue, and the icicles hung from the eaves in dangerous daggers, melting like mad. The sisters all sucked in their stomachs, cursing the extra piece of gingerbread, the honeyed cream and the coffee, vowing to do better. "Please, sweet Lurlina, let it be a man." The leader came out again and proffered a hand, and he helped a figure alight from the cabin, an old, creaky-limbed figure in sad, dark skirts and a hideously outfashioned bonnet, even from the provincial point of view. But Elphaba was leaning forward, cleaving the air with her sharp chin and hatchet nose, and sniffing like a beast. The visitor turned, and the sun struck her face.
"Good glory," breathed Elfie. "It's my old nanny."
And she left the parapet to run and gather the old woman in her arms.
"Human feeling, will you look at that?" said Four sniffily. "I wouldn't have guessed her capable."
For Auntie Guest was all but sobbing with pleasure. The caravan leader wouldn't stay for a meal. But Nanny, with her valises and trunks, clearly did not intend to go any farther. She settled in a small, musty room just below Elphaba's and took the endless time it takes the elderly to make her toilette. By the time she was ready to be sociable, dinner was served. A gamey old hen, more rope than flesh, lay in a thin pepper sauce on one of the good salvers. The children were dressed in their best, and allowed this once to dine in the formal hall. Nanny came in on the arm of Elphaba, and sat at her right hand. Because this was a visitor to Elfie, the sisters had kindly put Elfie's napkin ring at the foot of the table, opposite Sarima, a place by custom left vacant in honor of poor dead Fihiro. It was a big mistake, and they would recognize it almost immediately, as Elphaba never relinquished her advancement. But for now, all was smiles and savory hospitality. The only small annoyance, besides that Nanny wasn't a young, eligible princeling looking for a bride, was that Lear still conducted his campaign of sullen disappearance. The children didn't know where he was. Nanny was a tired and fruity old woman, skin cracked like dried soap, hair thin and yellowy white, hands with veins as prominent as the cords around a good Arjiki goat cheese. She communicated wheezily, with lots of pauses to breathe and think, that she had heard through someone named Crope in the Emerald City that her old charge, Elphaba, had attended Tibbet in his last days at the cloister of St. Glinda outside the Emerald City. No one in the family had heard from Elphaba in years and years, and Nanny had decided to take it upon herself to find her. The Maunts were reluctant at first, but Nanny had persisted, and then she had waited until a new caravan was ready to leave. The Maunts had told her about Elphaba's mission in Kiamo Ko, and Nanny had booked passage the following spring, and here she was. "And of the outside world?" asked Two eagerly. "Let them catch up on family gossip on their own time."
"What do you mean?" said Nanny.
"Politics, science, fashion, the arts, the driving edge," said Two.
"Well, our redoubtable wizard has crowned himself emperor," said Nanny. "Did you know that?"
They hadn't heard.
"By whose authority?" asked Five, scoffing. "And furthermore, emperor over what?" "There isn't anyone who has any more authority," he said Nanny calmly. "And who could argue with that? He's in the business of handing out honors annually as it is. He just tacked on an extra one for himself. As for emperor over what, I couldn't say. Some people whisper that this implies expansionist aims. But where he could expand to, I couldn't say. I just couldn't. Into the desert? Beyond? To Quox? Or Ix? Or Fleon?
Or does he mean to have a more tight-fisted hold on terrain he's only loosely governed?" asked Elphaba. "Like the Vincas?" She felt a chill, like an old wound deep beneath her breastbone.
"No one is particularly happy," said Nanny. "There is an enforced conscription now, and the gale force threatens to outnumber the royal army. One doesn't know if there could be an internal struggle for power, and the wizard is preparing against an eventual takeover attempt. How can one have an opinion about such things, old and female as we are?"
She smiled to include them all. The sisters and Sarima glared as youthfully as they could back at her. The next day hardly dawned at all, so gloomy with rain, so glowery with featureless clouds. In the parlor, waiting for Nanny to emerge and continue her obligation of entertaining them, the sisters and Sarima discussed what new facts they had learned about their auntie guest.
"Elphaba," mused Two. "It's a pretty enough name. Where does it come from?"
"I remember," said Five, who had once gone through a faintly religious phase when she realized marriage possibilities were growing dim. "I had a Lives of the Saints once. Saint Elphaba of the Waterfall. She was a Munchkinlander mystic, 6 or 7 centuries ago. Don't you remember? She wanted to pray, but she was of such beauty that the local men kept pestering her for attention.
They all sighed in chorus. To preserve her sanctity, she went into the wilderness with her holy scriptures and a single bunch of grapes. Wild beasts threatened her, and wild men hunted after her, and she was sore distressed. Then she came upon a huge waterfall coursing off a cliff. She said, "This is my cave," and took off all her clothes, and she walked right through the screen of pounding water. Beyond was a cavern hollowed out by the splashing water. She sat down there, and in the light that came through the wall of water, she read her holy book and pondered on spiritual matters. She ate a grape every now and then. When at last she had finished her grapes, she emerged from the cave. Hundreds of years had passed. There was a village built on the banks of the stream, and even a mill dam nearby. The villagers shrank in horror, for as children they had all played in the cavern behind the waterfall. Lovers had trysted there. Murders and foul deeds had taken place there. Treasure had been buried there. And never had anyone ever seen Saint Elphaba in her naked beauty. But all Saint Elphaba had to do was open her mouth and speak the old speech, and they all knew that it must be she, and they built a chapel in her honor. She blessed the children and the elderly, and heard the confessions of the middle-aged, and healed some sick and fed some hungry, that sort of stuff, and then disappeared behind the waterfall again with another bunch of grapes, I think a bigger bunch this time, and that's the last anyone has seen of her.
"So you can disappear and not be dead," said Sarima, looking out the window a little dreamily, past the rain.
"If you're a saint," said Two pointedly.
"If you even believe it," said Elphaba, who had come into the parlor during the end of the recitation. The re-emerging Saint Elphaba might have been some hussy from the next town over who wanted to give gullible peasants a good going over.
"That's doubt for you. It scours hope out of everything," Sarima said dismissively. "Auntie, you kill me sometimes, you really do."
"I think it would be charming to call you Elphaba," said Six, "because that is a charming story, and it's nice to hear your real name on Nanny's lips."
"Don't you try it," said Elfie. "If Nanny can't help herself, so be it. She's ancient, and it's hard to change, but not you."
Six pursed her lips as if to make an argument, but just then there was a clattering of feet from downstairs, and Nor and Irgy burst into the room.
"We found Lear," they said. "Come on, we think he's dead. He's fallen in the fish well."
They all pounded down the stairs to the basement. Chistery had been the one to find him. The snow monkey's nose had wrinkled when he and the boys passed the fish well, and he had whined and whimpered and tugged at the weighted cover. Nor and Irgy had had an idea to lower him down in the bucket then, but when they swiveled the cover off, the lurid gleam of light on pale human flesh had terrified them. Manic came running when he heard the noise of his mother and the others exclaiming before the well. They pulled Lear up. The water had risen, what with continued melting and the further rain. Lear was like a corpse left in a stream, bloated.
"Oh, is that where he was?" said Manic in a funny voice. "You know, he said he wanted to go down in that fish well once."
"Get away, children. You shouldn't see this. Go upstairs," Sarima said, scolding. "Come on now, behave. Upstairs for you." They didn't know what they were looking at, and they were afraid to look too closely.
"I cannot believe it. This is so terrible," said Manic excitedly, and Elphaba gave him a sharp, hateful look.
"Obey your mother," she snapped, and Manic made a nasty face, but he and Irgy and Nor clumped upstairs and huddled around the open doorway at the top to listen and peer.
"Oh, who has the art of medicine in their hands? Have you, Auntie?" asked Sarima. "Quick now, there may be time. You have the arts, don't you? You studied the life sciences. What can you do?"
"Irgie, go get Nanny. Tell her it's an emergency," shouted Elfie. "We'll bring him up to the kitchen, gently now." "No, Sarima, I don't know enough."
"Use your spells. Use your magic," exclaimed Five.
"Bring him back," urged Six, and Three added, "You can do it. Don't be hidden and shy about it now."
"I can't bring him back," said Elphaba. "I can't. I have no aptitude for sorcery. I never did. That was all a foolish campaign of Madame Morrible's, which I rejected."
The six sisters looked at her askance. Irgie escorted Nanny to the kitchen. Nor brought the broom. Manic brought the grimmery. And the sisters and Sarima brought the body of Lear, dripping and bloated, and laid him on the butcher's block.
"Oh, now, who's this one?" mused Nanny, but got to work pumping the legs and the arms, and set Sarima to pressing in at the abdomen.
Elphaba flipped through the grimmery. She screwed up her face and hit herself on the temple with her fists, and wailed,
"But I have no personal experience with a soul. How can I find his if I don't know what one looks like?"
"He's even fatter than usual," said Irgie. "If you prick his eyes out with a magic straw from the magic broom, his soul will come back," said Manic.
"I wonder why he went in the fish well," said Nor. "I never would."
"Holy Lurlina, mercy on us, mercy," said Sarima, weeping,
and the sisters began to mumble the service of the dead, honoring the unnamed god for the life departed.
"Nanny can't do everything," snapped Nanny. "Elphaba, be some help. You're just like your mother in a crisis. Put your mouth on his and push air into his lungs. Go on."
Elphaba wiped the wet off Lear's pasty face with the edge of her sleeve. The face stayed where it was pushed. She grimaced and nearly vomited and spit something into a bucket. And then she sank her mouth down on the child's and breathed out, pushing into the sour passage her own sour breath. Her fingers tensed at the sides of the butcher's block, gouging splinters as if in an ecstasy of sexual tension. Chistery breathed along with her, breath for breath.
"He smells like fish," Nor said under her breath. "If that's what you look like when you drown, I'd rather burn to death," said Irgie.
"I'm just not going to die," Manic said, "and nobody can make me."
The body of Lear began to choke. They thought at first it was an involuntary reaction, air from Elphaba's mouth pocketing and blurting out again. And then there was a small stream of yellowish yuck. Then Lear's eyelids moved, and his hand twitched of its own accord.
"Oh, mercy," Sarima murmured. "It's a miracle. Thank you, Lurlina. Bless you."
"We're not out of the woods yet," said Nanny. "He may still die of exposure. Quick now, off with his clothes."
The children watched the silly indignity of grown-up women tearing stupid Lear's trousers and tunic off. They rubbed him all over with lard. This gave the children a case of the giggles and made Irgie feel very funny in his trousers for the first time in his life. Then they wrapped Lear in a woolen blanket, which made quite a mess, and prepared to put him to bed.
"Where does he sleep?" said Sarima.
They all looked at one another. The sisters looked at Elphaba, and Elphaba looked at the children.
"Oh, sometimes on the floor in our room, sometimes on the floor in Nor's," said Manic.
"He wants to sleep in my bed, too, but I push him out," said Nor. "He's too fat. There'd be no room for me in my dowies."
"He doesn't even have a bed?" Sarima coldly asked Elfie.
"Well, don't ask me. This is your house," said Elfie.
And Lear stirred somewhat and said,
"The fish talked to me. I talked to the fish. The goldfish talked to me. She said she was...
Hush, little one, said Nanny. Time for that later.
She glared around at the women and children in the kitchen.
Well, it shouldn't take Nanny to have to find him a proper bed, but if there's none other for him, he can come up to my room and I'll sleep on the floor.
Of course not. The very idea, began Sarima, bustling ahead.
Barbarians, the lot of you, snapped Nanny,
for which no one in Kiamoko ever forgave her. Sarima lectured Auntie Guest severely for what had happened to Lear. Elphaba tried to say that it was not her doing, it was not her fault.
It was some boy's trick, some game, some dare, she said.
Their accusations spent, they fell to talking about the differences between boys and girls. Sarima told Auntie Guest what she knew of the boys' initiation rite in the tribe. They are taken out in the grasslands and left with nothing but a loincloth and a musical instrument. They are required to call forth spirits and animals out of the night, to converse with them, to learn from them, to soothe them if they need soothing, to fight them if they need fighting. The child who dies at night clearly lacks the discretion to decide if its company needs fighting or soothing. So it is correct that he should die young and not burden the tribe with his foolishness.
What do the boys say of spirits who approach them? Asked Auntie Guest.
Boys say very little, especially about the spirit world, she answered. Nonetheless, you pick up what you pick up, and I think some of the spirits are very patient, very wearing, very obdurate. The lore supposes there should be conflict, hostility, battle. But I wonder, in contact with spirits, if what the boy needs is a good helping of cold anger.
Cold anger?
Oh, yes. Don't you know that distinction? Tribal mothers always tell their children that there are two kinds of anger, hot and cold. Boys and girls experience both, but as they grow up, the angers separate according to the sex. Boys need hot anger to survive. They need the inclination to fight, the drive to sink the knife into the flesh, the energy and initiative of fury. It's a requirement of hunting, of defense, of pride, maybe of sex, too.
Yes, I know, said Elphaba, remembering.
Sarima blushed and looked unhappy, and continued. And girls need cold anger. They need the cold simmer, the ceaseless grudge, the talent to avoid forgiveness, the sidestepping of compromise. They need to know when they say something that they will never back down, ever, ever. It's the compensation for a more limited scope in the world. Cross a man and you struggle. One of you wins, you adjust and go on, or you lie there dead. Cross a woman, and the universe is changed once again, for cold anger requires an eternal vigilance in all matters of slight and offense. She glared at Elphaba, pinning her with unspoken accusations about Fiero, about Lear. Elphaba thought about this. She thought about hot anger and cold anger, and if it divided by the sexes, and which she felt, if either, if ever. She thought about her mother dying young, and her father with his obsessions. She thought about the anger that Dr. Dillamond had had, an anger that drove him to study and research. She thought about the anger that Madame Morrible could barely disguise, as she tried to seduce the college girls into the secret service of government. She sat and thought about it the following morning, as she watched the strengthening sun beat down on the mounds of snow on the sloping tiled roofs below. She watched the sun bleed ice water out of the icicle, warm and cold working together to make an icicle, warm and cold anger working together to make a fury worthy enough to use as a weapon against the old things that still needed fighting.
In a fashion, without any way to confirm it, of course, she had always felt as capable of hot anger as any man. But to be successful, one would need access to both sorts. Lear survived, but Manic did not. The icicle that Elphaba trained her gaze on, thinking on the weapons one needed to fight such abuse, it broke like a lance from the eaves and drove whistling downward and caught him in the skull as he went out to find some new way of beleaguering Lear. Uprisings.
"They're calling you a witch. Do you know that?" said Nanny. "Now, why ever is that?"
"Silliness and stupidity," said Elphaba. "When I arrived, I was distanced from my name, after my years at the Monterey, where I was called Sister Saint Elphaba. Elphaba seemed like the name of someone long ago. I told them to call me Auntie, though I never felt like anyone's auntie, nor would I know what it felt like. I never had any aunts or uncles."
"Hmm," said Nanny. "I don't think you're much of a witch. Your mother would be scandalized, bless her soul. Your father, too."
They were walking in the apple orchard. A cloud of blossoms thickened the air with scent. The witch's bees were having a field day, humming throatily. Killyjoy sat wagging his tail in the shadow of Manic's tombstone, placed near the wall. The crows had relay races overhead, scaring away all other birds except the eagles. Irgi and Nor and Lear, at Nanny's insistence, had been taken into the schoolroom of the village. Kiamo Ko was blissfully quiet until midday. Nanny was 78. She walked with a cane. She hadn't given up on her little efforts toward beauty, though now they seemed to coarsen rather than dignify her. Her powder was on too thick, her lip rouge smeared and off-center, and the flimsy lace shawl was useless in the updraft from the valley. For her part, Nanny thought that Elphaba was looking poorly, as if she were going moldy from the inside out. Pale, a disintegration of sorts. Elphaba didn't seem to care for her beautiful hair at all, keeping it knotted up out of sight underneath that ridiculous hat. And the black gown needed a good washing and airing. They stopped at a lopsided wall and leaned against it. The sisters were gathering flowers a few fields away, and Sarima ballooned along. In her dark morning gown, she resembled a huge, dangerous cocoon broken loose from its mooring. It was good to hear her laugh again, even if falsely. Light had that strange, ameliorative effect on everybody, even Elphaba. Nanny had told Elfie about her family. The eminent Throp had died at last. In Elphaba's absence and presumed death, the mantle of eminence had fallen to Nessa Rose. So the younger sister was now ensconced in Colwyn grounds, issuing dogmatic statements about faith and blame. Frex was there with her too, his career of ministry almost at an end. As he gave up the effort, his mind was returning to balance. Shell, he came and went. Rumors abounded that he was an agitator for Munchkinland's secession from Oz. He had grown up handsome and fine, in Nanny's biased opinion, straight of limb, clear of skin, direct of speech, bold of heart. He was now in his early 20s. "And what does Nessa Rose think of secession?" Elfie had asked. "Her opinion about it will be important if she's the eminent Throp now." Nanny reported that Nessa Rose had grown to be far cleverer than anyone anticipated. She kept her cards close to her chest and issued vague statements about the revolutionary cause, statements that could be read several ways, depending on the audience.
Nanny assumed Nessa Rose intended to set up some sort of theocracy, incorporating into the governing laws of Munchkinland her own restrictive interpretation of unionism.
"Your sainted father, Frex himself, doesn't know if this would be a good